This is Central Coast Public Radio, KCBX. I'm Tyler Pratt. It's time for Issues and Ideas, a show that features a wide variety of local voices sharing their thoughts and perspectives. Today, we'll hear about a local company that helps provide bicycles to people living in the developing world.
It builds an entire industry in these communities that didn't exist previously, and that employs a lot of people.
Also, we'll learn what businesses and employees can do to identify and prevent burnout.
This is really great, I can do this, but you gave me these 19 other things to do, and here's my calendar, and I really don't think I can do a good job if I add this 20th thing to my list. Can you tell me which one is most important, which one can wait?
These stories and more coming up on Issues and Ideas. Good afternoon. It's Monday, December 9th, 2019. I'm Tyler Pratt. In 2018, there were more than 55,000 incidents of gun violence in the United States. It's a lower number than the prior 2 years, but much higher than in years past. These numbers come from the group the Gun Violence Archive. It collects law enforcement data from thousands of agencies across the nation and compiles them into reports accessible online. And as of today, the group says there have been 393 mass shootings in the U.S. this year. While there is no standard definition of a mass shooting, many define it as an instance of gun violence where four or more people are injured or killed. The subjects of firearms and the Second Amendment, gun violence, and gun safety are polarizing and sensitive for many. Host Brian Reynolds wanted to explore these issues and recently had conversations with two people on the Central Coast with differing perspectives. The following segments represent the views of the speakers and not necessarily those of KCBX. KCBX welcomes comments, and you can email us at news@kcbx.org. First up is Brian Reynolds in discussion with Dr. Bill Plummer, president of the San Luis Obispo Sportsmen Association.
Bill, could you tell us a little bit about who you are, where you come from, and your background?
I grew up in North Carolina, went in the Army, got out, went to grad school, moved to Utah, working there, and then they had a job in California, and I came to California. And I decided, been here about 6 months, and I decided Denver's about as far east as I ever need to get back to.
It's so interesting. My family is from Southern Virginia, right near the North Carolina line, and I know the area well. It's beautiful, but not a lot shaken.
I had to get used to the idea of no trees.
Right.
Because it was all trees there.
Now you're a professor.
I recently retired from Cal Poly after 40 years in the animal science department.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And as president of Sportsman's Association, I oversee the public shooting range that we have between Cuesta College and Morro Bay.
Ah, okay. That's so interesting. I've been there a few times myself, and I didn't know that it was operated by the actual association itself. And I should self-declare, I am a gun owner myself, and I hopefully handle it safely and when I do handle them, and also have visited numerous occasions the shooting range and am a member of the association. So there you go, by way of self-disclosure. Let's talk about some of the particular points that you have made here that are salient, and so we'll frame the rest of our discussion.
The first thought out of my head is that 99.5% of the people who own firearms are safe, legal, they obey the laws. There's about a 0.5% which don't obey the laws. One of the big ones I keep thinking about is recently was passed by Governor Newsom is that you now have to undergo a background check and everything else to buy ammunition. So all of the people, 99.5% of those people are going to go, well, I have to go fill that out and do that. The other 0.5% is going to say, I have a brother in Las Vegas. I need to go visit him. And nobody's going to be looking in my car when I come back.
Right.
And so the law itself is only impacting the people who obey the laws in the first place.
Right. I'm sure that's true of many other phenomena in our society, like drinking responsibly or raising your kids responsibly. I mean, laws are made for the exceptions. I mean, in my view, laws made to protect everybody else because of the transgressions of often a tiny percentage.
It's sort of under the squeaky wheel thing where the people who are obeying the law, you never hear anything about. Somebody who disobeys the law with a firearm is now a squeaky wheel, so everybody wants to fix it.
Yeah, and it's understood. One of the things I was going to mention in our discussion prior to the show was the fact that as a librarian, my whole adult life, I love, of course, I love words. That's why I mentioned the firearm safety concept and using words properly, but also sharing data for the common good. Libraries do that excellently by sharing books, by sharing information, training, and so forth, all free, all for the public, for the improvement of the common person. And we know about sharing. It seems to me that one of the big defects in the firearm safety arena is the fact that there's a crazy quilt of agencies, military, law enforcement, who have data about who and should or shouldn't have access to firearm and ammunition, but they don't share. I mean, is there a database, let me put it that way, that is regional or national that is comprehensive? And do you think there should be if there isn't?
Well, the general one used is called a NICS, N-I-C-S. And it is designed to run by the FBI, and it's designed such that you go in, fill out paperwork to buy a firearm, and then they take the data from that and transmit it to the NICS Center. And now the NICS is supposed to have an answer back within about 3 hours. This is a national and international thing. California says, well, we command you fill out the form, and then 10 days later, we will have applied both to NICS and to the state to see what your situation is whether you should or should not be granted a firearm. And that's a 10-day wait rather than a 3-hour wait.
And why is that, do you think?
In California, it's because Californians, let's say that some of the people in government think they need to be able to run it, and they also think it's a safety thing. Part of it has to do with suicides.
I see, like a cooling off period.
Yeah, and that's what it comes down to.
You know, let's touch on that. That is a very important topic, and I'm not sure how well known it is. And I should also self-declare there is suicide in my family, not by firearm, but for me the topic is hugely important and tricky. And anyways, it's a huge challenge. I believe when I say this, and looking for your corroboration here, that by far the biggest harm done by firearms in this country is by a suicidal person to themselves?
Yes. Actually, it's about, the last report I read had about half of those that happen are suicide. The unfortunate aspect of it is that when people who want to ban handguns start talking, they mix in the accidental deaths, the intentional deaths, and the suicides.
All three.
Into one piece that says, this is what's going on in the world and it's what's causing all the problems.
How interesting.
To which it's split up, but it is not that way. No.
Yeah.
I admit that guns do make it handy. If I'm going to kill myself, it's handy.
Right. And it's quick.
And it's usually irreversible, although I have seen, there was actually an article in National Geographic 3 or 4 years ago about a young lady who tried and was not successful, but the amount of damage she did was taking years of surgeries and bone replants.
Oh boy.
To put her back together.
You know, one of the things we talked about too, and, you know, just I'm going to make a sort of a desperate analogy here, but speed and rapidity is, to me, a lot of times the enemy of life. Our ancestors' clocks, internal clocks, were driven by the seasons, by the sun and the moon. And I don't know that we're really adaptable yet to, as human beings, to instant everything, which the computers seem to claim to provide to us. But the firearm is pretty quick. you know, the bullet goes in and the trigger goes off, and whatever your thoughts before or regrets or priorities afterwards, they might change. But, you know, it happens in an eye blink. And one of the problems we did talk about, and you can read about it in the newspaper, is a person who uses a firearm illegally and for bad purposes, generally speaking, they are unpredictable. They're hard to discover before the event. A terrorist, for example, isn't going to tell anybody they're going to go blow up a building. A lot of suicides are very, very private about their plans. And so it's the window of making a better decision is really small, or really narrow, let's say. But clearly, if you're talking to me, accidental versus suicide versus, who knows, a shooter in a mosque or a Walmart, those are three very different populations. Let's say a child who gets into the gun safe, you know, unbeknownst, mm-hmm. or finds a loaded firearm. That's a different breed of cat from the other two. And so to me, it would require at least three different approaches, sociologically speaking. What I mean is there's one thing about accidental issues. There's a whole different other kettle of fish with, I'm mixing my metaphors, for the suicide, and then the terrorist or the criminal. There are three different approaches to me, pretty distinct.
Yeah, because you've got one is a person who intends to do harm or damage. And so whether it's a terrorist or it's a guy who robbed a bank or the guy who goes into the 7-Eleven, their intention is to create a situation where they're in control and they're going to prove they're in control because they got a gun.
Yeah, there's this internet notoriety thing, too, that is just our copycat issues that just kind of scare the pants off me. Let's talk about the accidental part. I think it's pretty straightforward terms of being – what I mean is gun safety, the rules, if you follow them, you're going to be safe.
Which takes away accidental.
Right.
It becomes what we classify as negligent.
Tell me, this is something that fascinates me, and I think I know the answer, but I want to hear it. Let's say you want to defend your home, and you have a firearm, and you need it to be handy, but you don't want an accident to happen. And so in my case, the firearms and the ammunition are stored far apart in my house and for safety purposes, but that's not going to help me if an intruder breaks through the back door while my wife and I are asleep. Are there gun safes that are accessible, that are instantly openable, like with a handprint or a is there any technology out there that would allow that?
I've seen them, all of them small enough to have to store one gun, and you lay three fingers on top.
Mm-hmm. Your own fingers.
Yeah, your own. It's fitted to your fingers. Mm-hmm. To a mantle above a fireplace,
mm-hmm.
you hit a button, and the bottom half of the mantle drops down, and there is where you have long guns, shotguns, rifles, and maybe another handgun or two.
Okay. I mentioned also that I read a book called Gunfight, which I wish I had to come with the author, but it's a historical treatment of guns from the colonial period to modern times. And I learned a lot of things. For example, there was a big boost in gun ownership. Guns were expensive after the Civil War because the soldiers, ex-soldiers on both sides, were allowed to take it home to protect their hearth and home and hunt and whatever else. But the thing that didn't surprise me was there are people at both extremes, and it didn't surprise me that there are quote-unquote gun nuts, people who, for whom a gun is not a tool but a almost like a religious icon, if you will. But I learned, to my surprise, that there's a small percentage of people on the gun control side who would want to eliminate personal use or possession of firearms altogether in this country. So my question is twofold. Do you think that's true, and what can we do to do a reality check on that?
If all firearms were removed from that 99.5% of the people, that 0.5% would be the one with firearms, and they would be ruling because, if you really get into the history books, that's what Stalin did to the Russians, took all their guns away prior to World War II. Mm-hmm. That's what Hitler did. That's what Idi Amin did in Africa. So everybody who's afraid of a revolution makes sure there's no guns, but that the good guys don't have any guns.
Interesting.
One of the things that doesn't seem to come up is that if we go back to, let's say, when I moved to California, there were 18 million people in the state of California in 1979. There are now well over 40 million. And so when you take the actual number of events at a low population, and then you get a much higher population, and things start occurring more often.
Sure.
Because you've now doubled it. Well, the entire planet is that way. And so everything like that is created problems.
What are some of the most common questions and also misconceptions that people need to know?
I guess the first one is that it's not necessarily a misconception. I think it's a place of not having thought about it. But guns are an inanimate object. They're just like the automobile. If we have somebody who gets drunk, runs over a dozen bicyclists, they don't blame the car. They blame the driver. And in this case, if somebody does something bad with a gun, any firearm, then the firearm is what gets chastised, not the person who did the work. And so it's because there are groups of people who want that 5% who want to take away all the guns, so they're going to demonize them in any way possible. And because of that, what the rest of the population hears is only what they're saying. And so they're saying, well, this is bad and we got to get rid of this. Well, that's fine, you get rid of it, but then the bad guys still have their guns, so are you willing to give up all of your guns because the bad guys have theirs?
That was host Brian Reynolds in conversation with Dr. Bill Plummer, president of the San Luis Obispo Sportsman Association. Now, for a different perspective, Reynolds later spoke with Morro Bay City Council member and founder of the Women's March SLO, Dawn Addis. And as a side note, the interview was recorded before Addis announced her candidacy for the State Assembly. She's running for the 35th district seat, which covers SLO County and northern Santa Barbara County. Here's their conversation.
We've come to a place where we have a false choice to make, and that seems to be the current narrative. The current narrative is or Second Amendment rights or safety for the general public and students in schools. And it's really a false juxtaposition. You can have both at the same time. And regardless of how much gun power there is, we can still have a safe society with access to guns. And that's really been what Women's March has advocated for and what March for Our Lives, when we supported March for Our Lives locally, has advocated for, is we need to have both.
I'm a real student of history. I like historical novels, but also histories and biographies. And a couple of years ago, I read supposedly one of the most definitive biographies of Wyatt Earp. In Tombstone, Arizona, in the early 1880s, we saw gun control rigidly enforced. Mm-hmm. The only people that were allowed to carry in town within the city limits were law enforcement or soldiers, military, I guess. And when you came to town from wherever, you checked your guns at the livery stable or at the marshal's office. And if you were carrying and you weren't one of those favored few, you got arrested.
Mm-hmm.
So that's the Wild West.
Mm-hmm.
it's kind of shocking, but in a good way. To me.
Well, and not at all. I think not at all what the gun safety movement is talking about.
Right.
And so it's important to put those things in their place in history and locate them there, and then also realize that what we're talking about is the present, and what we're talking about is children that are shot in their classrooms. What we're talking about is home is the most dangerous place for a woman. When there's a gun present, then domestic violence victims and survivors have a 7 times more chance of being killed. What we're talking about is the general public having access to high capacity firearms and high capacity ammunition. And so I think it's a very different conversation what we're facing today. And it's a solution that we can have without going backwards to what most Americans don't want. Most Americans want gun safety. Most Americans want universal background checks. Most Americans want to be able to send their children to school or to go to school themselves, whether they're in kindergarten or they're at the college level, and not be afraid that they're going to die.
I'd like to have you comment some more on the gender issues that are woven into this. To me, if there's going to be domestic violence in a home and there's also a firearm present, we're not talking about a little more likely, but 700, I could use that term, 700%, almost 10 times more likely to be in that arena. And then there's also the issue of the statistics that show that at least with mass shootings, 90%+ are, let's just say the word, angry young white men. And you were telling me that there's a group online or around the world that feeds on this. Could you talk about that?
Yeah, well, so two things. I think we have to be careful calling, you know, the angry young white men crazy when we call shooters of color terrorists or we call them predators. So we want to, I think, really be clear when we're talking about white shooters, they're also terrorists.
Right.
The community that you're referring to is the incel community, and it's people, generally men, who don't want to be celibate but haven't found the romantic relationship that they want and have a community online where they are very rabid towards women and often will hold these shooters up sort of as martyrs or icons who, you know, shooters from their community. And so it's very dark and it's very disturbing. And I think it is emblematic of why we need to be talking about gun safety in general, because these are also terrorists. There's an incel community that's also terrorist.
Right.
And so we need to be thinking about, if we're trying to keep weapons out of the hands of terrorists, what do we do around gun safety? And attack both. You know, there's often a false argument between is it mental health or is it gun safety? And in a lot of ways, it's both. But we want to be clear, I'll just say, because the word crazy was used, that folks who suffer from true mental health disabilities are more often the victims of crimes than the perpetrators of crimes. And we want to be clear that hate is not a mental illness. And so in the incel community, there's a lot of hatred there, and hate is not a mental illness. And when we think about mass shooters, a lot of it comes from white supremacist ideology, and that's not a mental illness.
I think the agencies that collect data about people's histories or their ability to, say, own a firearm, they could make some progress. I'm pretty sure that in the press recently, you know, so-and-so was a shooter and he'd been convicted of domestic violence while on active duty, but the Air Force didn't share it with the sheriff's department and yada, yada. I mean, I may not have the exact details right, but there are data out there that would be useful if they were shared in a timely and comprehensive manner.
Well, I'm glad you brought that up, and I think there's two problems with the data. One, there's not universal background checks, so that's an issue with sharing information. The other is that there is no federal funding to study gun violence as a health epidemic. And that funding was ended a couple of decades ago, and with the political situation that we've seen, you know, there's not been a lot of forward movement in getting federal funding to study gun violence as a health epidemic. So, you know, we were able to change the game when it came to automobile safety, both with wearing seatbelts, with motorcyclists wearing helmets, and with drunk driving laws. These were huge uphill battles, but we had to sort of shift public opinion and get some federal funding in there to be able to study what was going on. We were able to change the game around smoking, right? And who would have thought that the American people could take on the tobacco industry? But we have the Surgeon General's warning, and we know that there's many, many health studies on this. So right now, one of the huge pushes is to get federal funding to study gun violence as the health epidemic that it is across communities.
Why are there not universal background checks? A monster database that lives, say, somewhere outside of Washington, D.C., that receives and feeds back information nationwide from the tiniest town to the biggest city. Why do we not have that?
I think for the same reason we don't have a lot of other common sense gun safety legislation, and it has to do with the NRA and the amount of money that the NRA is able to pump into politics and to fund various, you know, election campaigns. And so when the NRA has such a stranglehold on people who are in decision-making positions, it's very challenging to make some of these shifts, even though the general public wants this. And it's interesting, I was at the Presidential Forum on Gun Violence, the first ever presidential candidate forum specifically for gun violence, and there were members there of a group called Gun Owners for Gun Safety. And they talked about the NRA, what the NRA used to be compared to what the NRA is now. And so in many communities, the NRA funds programs, and they fund programs for students, marksmanship programs,
and gun safety,
right. programs. But there's also an arm of the NRA that is connected to gun manufacturers and pumps a lot of money into politics. And so some of the statistics that we do know is when there's a mass shooting, typically gun manufacturers make more money because people get scared of two things: either that their guns are going to be taken away, or they feel like now they need to protect themselves. And so actually, financially, gun manufacturers are better off when we have a mass shooting. And when those folks are leading the NRA and that money is pouring into national politics, it creates a very destructive cycle where it's hard to change the laws. That said, I continue to go back to, you know, we got laws changed around tobacco. Some of our, many of our listeners, I think, will remember all of this. Some of the younger people who've grown up always wearing seatbelts won't remember what an uphill battle that was. Getting alcohol ads off of TV, right? But that comes from looking at it from a health perspective.
What could be the rationale to resist universal background checks? You'd think that would be a nonpartisan, a bipartisan issue. And you, and maybe anticipating what I was going to ask, I mean, is it really that simple and crass that if there's a database out there that prohibits a certain percentage of people from owning a firearm and doing bad things with it, that guns manufactured and ammunition profits would sag and that's a bad thing? Is that what we're talking about?
I don't know if they see a direct correlation between that, or if it's more that they feel like they have the power of the Second Amendment and they have plenty of money. And so some people may see it as an erosion, like a small erosion, and they're aware of what's happened in other industries, and so they're fighting that much harder.
In other words, we might tolerate this today, but it's going to get worse, and it's a sneak attack kind of thing.
I assume some people feel that way, and I assume, you know, when you're a profit-driven company, that you're paying attention to everything.
One of my favorite epiphanies recently is capitalism is an economic model, not a system of moral values.
Absolutely.
But we have religionized, I guess we could say that, weaponized certain things. We can religionize profit and owning stuff. I'd like to shift gears into the three big rocks of gun violence. One rock would be accidental shootings. Mm. One would be suicide. And the other would be homicides of various types, domestic and otherwise. Would you agree that they each need a slightly different approach, but there's probably some overlap?
I would agree there's a lot of overlap. For instance, I think I called them red alert. They're called red flag laws. So if you know somebody is a potential harm to their self or others, that's an overlap with both suicide and homicide. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. I think the universal background checks, again, that's a overlap between suicide and homicide. Same thing with access to high capacity weapons. There's a lot of overlap there. I do think with the accidental gun deaths, there are campaigns specifically through Moms Demand Action and for Gun Sense in America. They have a campaign on educating students and educating families to ask about guns in the home and to have, you know, specific safety precautions for guns in the home, because often accidental shootings are, you know, guns that are lawfully owned. They're just not locked up, or
Correct.
There's not a trigger lock, or they're loaded, right? And somebody who shouldn't have them, usually a child, gets to them. So I do see that one as a little bit bit different. Mm-hmm. And the homicide suicide issue, I think, is huge. And it speaks to the need. One of the things that came up at that presidential forum was the need for, you know, national legislation, because your state could enact the most restrictive legislation, and then somebody crosses state lines with guns from a state that has less restrictive laws, or from a nation, possibly, you know, Mexico, Canada, or bringing guns in from somewhere else. And so that's one of the reasons that we need national attention on this issue.
As we approach the end of our discussion, what would be some key takeaways that you'd want people to remember and maybe be inspired by rather than discouraged?
First and foremost, people have to speak up. If you care about gun violence, if you worry about your kids when they go to school, if you're worried that they might be caught in a school shooting, if your child is telling you they're concerned, if ever in the back of your mind it's a concern when your kids go to their friends' houses, or if you're a person who gets nervous in large space events and you have that, like, gosh, you know, I worry about gun violence, you have to speak up. Write to your congressperson, write to your senators. Those are the people, Congressman Carbajal, Senator Harris, and Senator Feinstein. Those are the people that have the power to get movement. And there's been movement in the House, not as much movement in the Senate. And so we have to let our representatives know that this is in the forefront. And then also to check what's happening in your local school district, check what's happening in your city. Like, what are the gun safety measures that are going on? On city council, we've talked about, you know, wanting to have something come in front of us to look at what are the options for cities. There's not a lot, but there's some. And then I think the other thing is, you know, we're not powerless. And as soon as we say to ourselves we can't change anything, then we've given our power away. But we have to remind ourselves, and it's, you know, something I just keep saying over and over again. If we look at what Mothers Against Drunk Driving did, changing the game for people being able to drink and drive, if we look at what happened with the tobacco industry, if we look at what happened with people riding motorcycles and needing to wear helmets, these were huge industries that the American public went up against. And I think you brought up earlier the Me Too movement. You know, when people speak up, things start to change, but we can't lose hope. Ever.
Right. I think when you're, I don't know, maybe on the conservative side, you would be worried about dark forces, you know, attacking home and hearth. And so your fears would be paramount and how to deal with that. But if you're on the progressive side, it's keeping your courage up, I think. And remember, don't ban things necessarily, but make the bar very, very high. I mean, one example would be if you want an assault rifle, explain why.
Well, exactly. And we have driver's licensing, right? So we could have that kind of a, exactly. You don't have to ban things. There's other ways that you can do it. You could also, I believe it's San Jose just put into play needing to have special insurance if you're a gun owner.
Right.
So, I mean, there's things like that that you can put into play. But what I would say to sort of the conservative liberal debate is that gun violence doesn't choose political parties. And we've seen that time and time again. Like, being a victim of gun violence is not about what party you're from. It could happen with any of us. And that's the conversation that we need to stay focused on, is that the American public is the American community, and together we can make a shift in this issue.
That was Morro Bay City Council member and founder of the Women's March Slow, Dawn Addis, speaking with host Brian Reynolds. The previous conversations were views of the speakers and not necessarily those of KCBX. KCBX welcomes comments of those with divergent views. You're listening to Issues and Ideas. Correspondent Tom Wilmer recently visited with design engineers from the bicycle component manufacturer SRAM. They have a facility in San Luis Obispo. In support of World Bicycle Relief, which is coming up on December 13, SRAM will be hosting a fundraiser. Wilmer got to know more about the facility as well as World Bicycle Relief, which provides locally assembled bicycles to students, healthcare workers, and entrepreneurs in rural areas of developing countries around the world.
I'm Tom Wilmer, reporting from the KCBX studios. Come along and join us as we visit with Garrett Smith,
Director of Design Engineering, and Will King, Design Engineer at SRAM, which is?
SRAM is a global manufacturer of bicycle components who also has a charity arm that we're heavily involved with called World Bicycle Relief.
A moment about the retail brands of bicycles where the SRAM product exists.
You can pretty much name any large bicycle manufacturer in the world and they would be a customer of ours. So the ones we typically know of here in the U.S. would be Specialized, Trek, Cannondale, Scott. Here in San Luis Obispo, we do development of new parts, usually several years ahead of what you see in the market. So we are sensitive, I guess, with how open we are. We have locations all over the world. You know, Chicago is our headquarters. We happen to have a number of different development locations as well as factories.
Here in San Luis, you guys do your futuristic engineering.
We do some of that, yeah, among other development locations, yeah. So
even though SRAM is a commercial operation for the bicycle industry, you are opening your doors to support a nonprofit.
Yeah, absolutely. So World Bicycle Relief was founded by a founding member of SRAM. It's a philanthropic organization to deliver bicycles to people in need around the world. Once a year, we open our doors to kind of show people behind the scenes, our somewhat secret development location here, right, provide an experience. And the money that we earn in donations through that event goes towards World Bicycle Relief, trying to help people in need.
Do you still have a Buffalo bike there at the location that people could see?
We do. Yeah. We've got two.
One of every generation.
One of every generation. Yeah. There might be three. Yeah.
So when people come out for the open house, they can tangibly touch it and maybe even ride it around. And
sure. Absolutely. Yeah. As well as eat some great food and see some really cool equipment, behind the scenes look at how SRAM develops parts. But really, that's all for World Bicycle Relief.
World Bicycle Relief was started in 2005 as some disaster relief in Sri Lanka to the tsunami that happened there. And since then has grown to be actually stretching across South America and Africa now, providing bicycles to people in communities in need of that mode of transportation. And the focus of the donated bicycles is to students and healthcare workers. And then as the organization has grown, the communities have said, hey, could we purchase this bicycle? So we sell them to like dairy farmers and people that are using it as a tool, and that then lowers the cost and the overhead for the donation bicycle.
And they really are a life-changing mode of transportation for a lot of these people.
These people are walking everywhere. Like, typical example of a recipient of student would be 10 to 11 mile walk to get to school. They'll get a bicycle, and then they're able to go to school 5 days a week instead of two or maybe 3 days a week.
We talked last year about how it's a literal game changer for some of these kids, these students. They could not go to school if they couldn't ride a bike for a couple reasons.
The distance is a factor. There's also doing all the chores at home, taking care of what they need to put food on the table. And then there's also the danger of the elements out there. In many of these areas, such as the one I visited, Zambia, it's really, really hot in parts of the year, so walking becomes an obstacle to that. There's lots of large animals that live there.
They could get eaten.
Yeah, and especially, you know, after the sun sets, right? If you have that long of a walk, right, you might be walking for 2 or 3 hours. And when the sun goes down, the animals come out and, you know, nobody wants to mess around with a lion, right?
Literal lifesaver, game changer.
Yeah, and we'd like to say that donated bicycle will affect, on average, about 5 people because that student will take it to school, but then that student will also be able to use it to help their family out when they're not at school. Sometimes their parents will use it as well, but the primary objective is to get that student to school.
And then the second level you alluded to earlier is the bicycle as a transport for goods and services.
Right. So World Bicycle Relief had been around for about 5 years, and the people in the community said, hey, you make the most robust bicycle out there. It's called the Buffalo, and it weighs 54 pounds made of steel.
Industrial,
yep. The idea is that the bicycle is a serviceable vehicle that's not going to break down in the harsh African environment. And so because that time had been put into that design, then the locals recognized that and said, hey, could this vehicle be available to others other than the healthcare workers and the students. And that's where World Bicycle got creative with how they structured their business and made the sale of that nonprofit bicycle to the locals kick back in to reduce the overhead of making the bicycle and then also contribute to reducing the price to a donated bicycle.
Garrett, talk to us about the bicycle itself and designing it and making it as bulletproof as you can.
SRAM itself doesn't make the bicycles. World Bicycle Relief has their own development team that works on designing the bike specifically for the usage that they're trying to achieve in that environment. And they've partnered with supply chain, mostly in Asia, to actually build those bikes. They're assembled, I think, largely on location, yeah, in Africa, which provides local jobs as well.
Will and I talked previously about you deliver a bike and they're in great condition, but then just because of the environment, if they break or break down, that can be a game breaker.
Yeah, so the success in World Bicycle's story is that you're empowering the community to take these vehicles, have the children or the healthcare workers use Buffalo Bicycle, and then them also be serviced. So you're employing people to assemble the bikes. You're employing people to maintenance and manage the bikes, right? If you get a flat tire, then that's no good, especially if it's a 14-year-old that doesn't know how to change the flat tire. So there's mechanics that are employed. And then it's also recognizing the right community that's ready to accept, let's say 200 bicycles is what would come into a school, and know that those 200 bicycles are still going to be rolling in 3 years.
I remember a long time ago you telling me a story about your time over there and how one healthcare worker alone, because you guys got her a bike, she was able to ride that bike to deliver healthcare to people, and she rode as much as 60 miles a day.
In the community we're in Zambia, one-third of the people have AIDS and HIV. And so the program that they're instituting there is they're trying to get the people to come into the healthcare clinic and take the ARV medication. That's the whole thing about keeping that virus low. And so we asked, what's the farthest distance you ever rode to see a patient? And yeah, she said 60 miles a day is kind of a normal to go see patients and try to convince people.
On a one-speed bicycle.
On a one-speed bicycle on dirt roads. And then she said the farthest she's gone is 60 miles one way. Wow. To see a patient. It's really just about being able to see more people and convince them that getting on the medication is going to help their livelihood.
So without the bike, that healthcare worker would have been on foot and would maybe be able to walk 10 miles, 12 miles a day, 20 miles a day on the outside?
Yeah. I mean, what we say in the World Bicycle Relief materials is that three times the distance can be covered with a bicycle in the same amount of time. So I would say in that example, probably that person wouldn't have gotten visited and not cared for.
So literally a life-saving game changer for these communities.
Yeah, absolutely, Tom. That message was very clear to me from my trip with World Bicycle Relief over to Zambia.
And there's that learning curve, what the bicycle industry learns about designing and building a bicycle can be applied to the Buffalo bike to design out some of those weak links.
Yeah, for sure. The design criteria for the Buffalo bike are quite different from the criteria we're using here, but we actually share a lot of knowledge between the two organizations. And actually, the VP of product development in World Bicycle Relief used to work for me as one of my engineering managers, so there's a really close tie there. You know, I think what Will was starting to speak to that really fascinates me about World Bicycle Relief as an organization and really a strategy is how it builds an entire industry in these communities that, you know, we didn't exist previously, and that employs a lot of people.
Back to the basic design of the Buffalo bike, shifting, and is it a coaster brake? You know, how does that work?
Yeah, it is a coaster brake, and there's no shifting. It's not at all like the bicycles you see, you know, most of SRAM's components designed for, which are sort of the Tour de France level, you know, performance, World Cup racing bicycles, right? Yeah, the Buffalo bike is completely different. I mean, weighs 50 plus pounds, is all steel, right? You need to create that thing using technology that can be serviced with a hammer and a screwdriver.
Yeah, and the rear rack, that's an interesting one too. The weight capacity on the rear rack is such that two or three people can ride on the bicycle total, right? And so when I visited Zambia, my experience was that you see these bikes and there's hardly ever one person. There's always one or two people riding on the rear rack as well. So it's a good design problem to say, what's the use case here? And then how do we best serve that market where the, you know, the likely, you know, available tools could even just be a rock and a stick, right? You know, there have been other programs that World Bicyclists have studied extensively that are taking a more U.S. or European-made bicycle and donating that into the market like this. Well, if your replacement chain costs $40, then once a chain breaks, you can pretty much guarantee that that bike is, you know, not going to be running anymore. So you need to make those serviceable parts at an affordable price. And that's where, as Garrett was alluding to, the whole sourcing matrix of World Bicycle Relief with, you know, all the Asian manufacturers. And I think the seat comes from India. And, you know, it's partnering with people that understand what we're trying to do with this philanthropic cause and are willing to, you know, be on that business side of things too, right? Not accept the same margins because we're empowering these communities that otherwise wouldn't have this transportation mode.
So, and that brings us back to San Luis Obispo and SRAM in an upcoming event, a fundraiser. Talk to us about that.
On December 13th, we're going to be opening our doors for the Tour de SRAM 2019. This is where we kind of showcase what we do in our location here. And as Garrett alluded to before, we're several years ahead of market release when we're doing product development. So we don't open our doors very often. And then when we do, people usually really enjoy the tour because we've got a real high-tech facility.
So what you're saying is we get to go to the secret crypto development rooms and see the equipment and see the design elements on the computer as it's happening.
Yeah, we'll do we do a tour with not just our test equipment and how we break this stuff, but we start at the product development side, how we analyze it up front, what materials we select and how we select them. You might even get to find out about unobtainium.
Which is?
Well, you have to come to the tour to find out what unobtainium is. And then we go back in the lab. Garrett, do you want to speak to some of the facilities that we have in the lab?
Sure. So the entire location here is really set up, even though we have some sales and marketing staff on site, it's really a product development location. The whole goal of that facility is to quickly go from an idea, a design idea, to being able to make it, to being able to evaluate it. So we've got everything from, you know, all the computer-aided design equipment there, of course, for the engineers to work with, but then also the prototype facilities to be able to make the stuff on site, prototypes, and all the test equipment to be able to completely evaluate it. We break lots of parts.
Intentionally,
yeah. I mean, breaking parts is the only way to really understand its limits.
Let's loop back again to World Bicycle Relief. And at the open house, you're going to be able to see a presentation about the Buffalo Bike and how somebody could donate and get involved.
Yeah. Will, in the past, has done that presentation showing the slideshow summation of his experiences in Africa when he was there following bikes around, Buffalo Bikes around, and the donation chain. I don't know if you're going to be doing that again this year.
Well, yeah, of course. We've got to share that story. So the event, December 13th, from 5 to 9 p.m., we're doing several tours of the facility. So pre-register online, tourtosram2019.com. It is limited space. And then we've got some tours in there. You can see the schedule. We were going to have tacos and beer for sale. The entry to the event is free. I'll be giving my presentation on my trip to Africa Rides trip to Zambia. And then we also have an auction going on to raise money for World Bicycle Relief, SRAM Axis Road, and Mountain Group Set will be auctioning off. So if that interests you, you can come see how it's made and bid on a drivetrain to raise money for a good cause.
And last year, my wife and I, you talked us into funding a bike. And as I remember, I think it was $149 we paid for the entire cost of the bike. Is that right?
Yeah, $147. Wow. Very close, Tom. Yeah, $147 gets a bike donated to somebody in need. So that includes all the costs involved, which World Bicycle focuses on keeping that very low and most of that money going towards the material cost of the bicycle. And it's really just a moving tangible cause, right? Knowing that you could provide a mode of transportation for somebody and it be that $147.
Remember in your slideshow, you had this cool picture of some guy that had like two giant containers of milk on the back rack.
Yeah, that would be the milk dairy user, which is the person that buys the bike, beats it up, and then tells us how we can improve it.
Do you have a website that somebody could go to?
Yeah, we've got a website set up for the event. It's Tour de SRAM 2019. Day is D-E, so TOURDESRAM2019.com. And that's our fundraising page, as well as all the details for schedule.
Will King, thanks for sharing. Garrett Smith, a pleasure.
Our pleasure. Thanks for having us.
You're welcome. And I'm Tom Wilmer.
You're listening to Issues and Ideas on KCBX. I'm Tyler Pratt. Some KCBX staff members recently attended the inaugural Spokes Nonprofit Symposium. Spokes is a local organization that provides resources for nonprofits. During the symposium, speakers gave lessons on how to create digital fundraising strategies. And the symposium also provided advice on self-care in understaffed workplaces with overworked staff. KCBX's Morning Edition host, Rachel Duchak, interviewed the event's main speaker. Beth Cantor is a master trainer, speaker, author, and blogger. Cantor discusses her presentation and workshop themed Digital Resilience from the Inside Out. She explains how for-profit and nonprofit businesses can identify and address burnout in their employees. Here is part of their conversation.
Well, it was a very personal idea, and I came to it through my own burnout and bouncing back from that, and then realizing that when you begin to take care of yourself and set some boundaries, you can actually be more productive at work. So it shouldn't be this thing that's separate. It really should be baked into the way you do your work.
Yes, you were saying that it's part of doing the work is taking care of you. The self-care is part of doing the work, whether you're in a nonprofit or any kind of business.
Yes, I really think that is true. And our mindset is really, oh, we'll do that later. But it really needs to be woven throughout the day. We're working in really difficult times. And even for-profits as well as nonprofits, it's very high-pressured. And that stress is killing people. We're killing ourselves in the nonprofit sector for a good cause. Mm-hmm. And so I think we need to start to understand the importance of building that personal resilience muscle while in the workplace, which is then creating that culture of resilience or well-being.
And you mentioned the word burnout, which is a lot of what this morning session was focused on. Can you give us your definition of burnout?
Sure. It's feeling that you're constantly overwhelmed with too many things to do and not enough recovery time.
How can, if your bosses are asking too much, how do you get your boss to stop asking too much?
Oh, that's a really great question. I think all of us need to have managing up skills.
Tell me what that means, managing up skills.
Well, okay, a quick example. If a boss is piling on 20 things for you to do and to get done by tomorrow, then you need to say, this is really great, I can do this, but you gave me these 19 other things to do, and here's my calendar, and I really don't think I can do a good job if I add this 20th thing to my list. Can you tell me which one is most important, which one can wait? And actually, there's research behind this that shows that if people feel like they can push back and there's a little bit more flexibility on deadlines, that they're in the end will do a better job and it's less stress. And another thing that happens, and I know it's probably not as applicable to a news organization, but I think it's applicable to a nonprofit. Nonprofits, we want everything to be an A+ at 100%. And because we're perfectionists, and not everything needs to be 100%. And so there's this concept called satisficing.
And it's satisficing.
Yes, you can put 80% effort and still get the same result. So then you have another 20% that you can redirect into something else.
We were talking before we started this recording about givers and takers and relationships, and it seems like a lot of the happiness at work has to do with how I'm interacting with my coworkers who I have to see every day. And in a relationship, in a personal relationship, if you are a giver and you're with a taker, that can be a really unhappy thing. It seems like it's a similar kind of thing in any workplace, not just nonprofits.
Oh, absolutely. I think, as you saw, the number one thing that came up in terms of stress triggers was, relationship, collaboration, and communication with other employees. So I think we have to recognize in ourselves, we have to have a good sense of emotional intelligence and social intelligence, so we know what somebody is, and the skills to kind of manage that, whether the management is putting a boundary or it's improving your communication skills. One of the techniques I teach a lot is empathetic listening.
Tell us what that is.
It's really simple. It's just being able to rephrase back what the person said to you and keeping your mouth shut, not interrupting them. Body language, leaning forward, and it makes such a difference. I've even found it really useful in my personal life with my teenagers.
Big smile there.
Yes. Well, I think that we need to create cultures where we're open to constructive criticism, and that helps us do a better job in the end. So it's not really about me criticizing you to make you feel bad. Hopefully I'm giving you some constructive feedback that helps us all get to reach a better result with changing the world, whatever that is, in a more effective and efficient way.
So this session that you're offering for us, we've started off this morning with talking about burnout, and you'll be having some ideas on digital fundraising, which probably has a degree of stress, and also it can be kind of liberating because it's a tool that helps you reach people in a way that people are, you don't have to call them on the telephone or send them a piece of mail, right?
Yes, yes. I like to think about the whole, I frame the whole thing of digital resilience from the inside out. So we did the inside this morning, and now this is the outside. Mm-hmm. And so a lot of what I'm going to be teaching this afternoon is how to have empathy for your donor and understanding the donor's needs and what stories resonate, what channels they use, how they want their information.
Is there something special with nonprofits where there is no end in sight for these issues?
Oh, well, and that's part of some of the burnout that happens, is that especially with people that work with disaster recovery or working with clients who are in difficult straits, like, you know, homeless or domestic violence or kids that have been abused or animals that have been abused. And that's why it's really important for those types of nonprofits to have training, resilience training, dealing with trauma. That should be a required piece of working at the organization. And I was shocked that there are some organizations that should, large organizations that don't do this.
Your staff is a really important resource. We spend a lot of time identifying staff, getting people trained up, as you say, and it's a money-saving thing to save your staff from burning out and moving on, right?
Absolutely, and especially the younger generation, so-called millennials, when they go to apply for jobs, they're not just looking at money, salary, and what the job is. They also look at culture, and they want to know, you know, is this a burnout bin? Is this an abusive workplace, or is this one where there's a lot of camaraderie and opportunities for growth?
You talked about one of the good things that you can do for your work environment is to take a walking meeting. I know that meetings are a source of frustration for a lot of people. That could have been an email, and you dragged me into a meeting. And sometimes if meetings are not conducted in a lively, vibrant way, it makes people's brains take a walk someplace else. So you mentioned a walking meeting. How does one conduct a walking meeting?
Well, it's simple. I actually like to call them strolling meetings right now because not everybody walks. Some people roll, people who use wheelchairs, and also walking meetings are not a race. The slowest person sets the pace. So a walking meeting is actually a meeting that you do outside the office walking. And now I get a lot of resistance to, where are we going to show the screen, or how are we going to take notes? Well, it's really about the discussion and the relationship. And I always recommend that people start with a one-to-one meeting as their walking meeting. There's nothing better than walking shoulder to shoulder, especially if you give feedback and building that kind of relationship.
Checking in at meetings, I heard a lot of really great ideas, pumping up the volume, really appreciating what you're doing, particularly important for nonprofit work because it can be kind of emotionally draining. And you had lots of really great tips. What's the first book I should listen to? Or do you have them on audiobooks or are they written books?
They're written books. The Happy Healthy Nonprofit, Strategies for Impact Without Burnout. And you can find a link at my website, which is www.bethcantor.org.
So what's one last thing that you would like the listeners here of this interview to walk away with in terms of how we can manage or even get started with the small changes and the large changes for having a more fulfilling work situation?
I would suggest that you get everybody on the same page and have a conversation about it and start with, you know, how can we make this a more friendly workplace? How can people feel more appreciated? Do we have everything we need to function? How can we make, do we feel fulfilled? And then if the answer is no, how can we turn that around and come up with a couple of ideas and pilot a few things? Get started with some small steps.
That was KCBX's Rachel Duchek speaking with Beth Cantor, who is a master trainer, speaker, author, and blogger at the recent inaugural Spokes Nonprofit Symposium. You've been listening to Issues and Ideas on KCBX Central Coast Public Radio. Gary Eister composed our theme music. A special thanks to all of our guests and contributors this week. I'm Tyler Pratt. We have one more Issues and Ideas show left in the year, followed by a Playing with Food holiday special with Father Ian Dellinger in 2 weeks. Join us for the next two Mondays from 1 to 2 in the afternoon for more local stories. You can head to our website to learn more about what you heard today or listen to past segments. It's all at kcbx.org.